Good evening, everybody. Just good to see you tonight. It's always good to be in the house of the Lord. One of the highlights of every week for me is going deeper. I just can't wait, and so I'm so glad you're here. The cliffs of Mount Arbel in the Galilee region of Israel are unforgettable. And I must confess, part of the reason I go to Israel every other year is because I'm drawn to them. I'm just drawn to them. They command the Galilee, and below them rests an ancient trace called the Valley of the Doves. It's a trail Jesus would have walked many, many times, but I've got to tell you, every time I walk that trail, it stirs my soul somehow. Not because I'm walking where Jesus walked. That's actually 30 feet underneath us. It's because I'm seeing what Jesus saw, and I'm actually 30 feet closer to it. Since much of the Galilee is actually below sea level, the cliff of Arbel's impact is roughly twice its height. It soars about 1,200 feet above the region, roughly twice the height of the St. Louis Arch. Jesus spent the vast majority of his ministry in Galilee. Probably three quarters of his ministry happened there. I always figure in Jesus' day, just like today, you had blue-tuniced and white-tuniced workers. The people of Galilee were blue-tuniced workers. They made their living with their hands. Every time you read the Bible, particularly the Gospels, please keep in mind two things. If you are in the Gospels and you just take a deep sniff of your Bible, you should smell fish. And number two, remember all these people had calluses on their hands. These weren't soft-handed people. Matthew probably was. He was a tax collector. But these are people that had calluses on their hands. Their lives were shaped by hard work, politics, oppression, the lake, the soil, and the mountains. They made their living pulling tilapia out of the Sea of Galilee. They put them in salt barrels, and they shipped them all over the empire. They harvested crops from the Jezreel Valley, also called Armageddon, and they made things that people needed. Artisans made their living building cities like Sepphoris and making practical things out of wood and stone, mainly stone. We always think of Jesus being a tecton. In Greek, we would translate that carpenter. Joseph was a carpenter, a tecton. But if you go to Israel, there are a million stones for every tree. So Jesus would have primarily fashioned things out of stone. And the people who lived there paid way too much in taxes to ever get ahead. Roman subjugation and the economic oppression that it brought was the one thing that filled the minds of the people of Galilee every single day of their lives. Jesus is raised just 15 miles from the lake in Nazareth, and it's in the Galilee he received his religious education in the synagogues. He learned to trade, he called his disciples, he healed, he delivered, and he taught about the kingdom of God. If you ever wonder why the crowds were so big, it's because he healed and he fed. And because he healed and fed, people would stay and listen. At first, he taught in Jewish synagogues, small structures. Every town in Galilee that had at least 10 Jewish families would have a synagogue. A lot of them are tiny. They've uncovered them. I mean, they're just tiny. The footprint is really, really small. And the synagogues kind of had open mic nights. The leader of the synagogue would read the scripture, and then basically somebody could just kind of come up and share. It was sort of like Old Testament karaoke. They would just sort of get up and they would share, and then the people kind of judged whether or not they felt that person was from God or not of God. Jesus did that for a while, but before long, he started playing in open-air venues. And these meetings happened in two locations, primarily on the seashore, when the wind was blowing in or on mountainsides that provided natural amphitheaters. Over the past weeks, we've been exploring the dangerous ideas of Jesus of Nazareth. The material we are exploring in this dangerous ideas series is recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, and it sits in what we call the Sermon on the Mount. I want you to think for a minute about the people who listened to the teaching. Often we hear the teaching, and we act like the teaching was just to anybody, or everybody, or maybe to us. But it wasn't. The teaching was given to the people who were listening to him at that time. And one of the macro frustrations that everybody would have brought to the mountain would have been political. These were politically oriented people, and they vibrated at high frequencies. Remember that Jesus lived his life in the decades that would precede a Jewish revolt against the Romans. It would be summarily smashed. The steam, however, for this apocalypse that would come was already building. And you can't understand the volatility of the Gospels, especially Holy Week, without an understanding of the political environment of the time. We are in a political churn in ancient Israel. The second frustration would have been economic. It would have been economic. Common people didn't have enough money to provide a decent life for their families. And they frankly couldn't figure out how to access more of it short of becoming turncoats like tax collectors or thieves. Once the emperor, who was Tiberius, the governor, who was Pilate, the king, who was Herod Antipas, the tax collectors and the temple all took their shares, there really wasn't much left. Some historians estimate that by the time everybody got done fleecing the people of ancient Israel, the tax rate set about 90%. That did cause a little frustration. The Galileans were obsessed with money in the way you can only be obsessed when you don't have any, and you're unlikely to get any. You think about money all of the time. Like many people today who feel deep in their hearts all their problems could be solved with a winning lottery ticket, Galileans thought money would solve all of their problems. That, my friend, is one of the biggest lies the devil has ever concocted. Have you ever seen the stories of these people who win the lottery? These stories do not turn out well. They do not turn out well. These people in Jesus' time dreamed of a Messiah who's not only going to usher in God's kingdom, who's not only going to usher out the Romans, but they're going to unclog the economic drain at the top so a lot more can trickle down to the people. We've now emerged from the pedagogy, art and science of teaching. We've emerged from the pedagogical section covering offerings, prayers, and fasting. And the big idea in that section is that all acts of piety will be rewarded. And we have to choose whether we grandstand our good works and post them on Facebook and receive our rewards from people in the number of likes, or we do our good works in secret, and we receive our reward from God in heaven. Well, now we shift to a new section, but you got to understand, it carries on the theme of the old section. There's two schools of thought in Jesus' day concerning the hot topic of money and possessions. First of all, there were ascetic movements like the Essenes in Qumran. Those of you that go to Israel with me, our next trip's in 2020, January. There's some brochures out front, but we are going to visit Qumran on this. One of these groups, these isolationist, kind of apocalyptic sort of groups, were called the Essenes. They thought money was evil, and they thought possessions were evil. So they sort of lived communally. You had to give up any rank, privilege, anything that had to do that made you any better than anybody else in the eyes of the world. Financially, you have to give that up while you live with the Essenes. It is a radically egalitarian movement. But their thinking was that money was a bad thing. It corrupted people. And you certainly could build an argument for that. But most folks saw wealth as a blessing to be pursued. You got to remember, they didn't have the New Testament. They had the Old Testament. And the central figure of the Old Testament is Abraham. Abraham is the man. Abraham takes a polytheistic world and he introduces monotheism, the belief in many gods to the belief in one God. Abraham is absolutely the groundbreaking person of the Old Testament. It's not surprising to me that he's claimed as the father of three major monotheistic faiths today. Abraham is a groundbreaker. He heard the voice of the one God in a world where people thought there were gods under every rock. And the theology that grew from that had to do with Abraham. Part of the Abrahamic covenant is that God is going to bless him. And I don't mean in heaven someday. I mean on earth today. And God is going to give him prosperity. And prosperity in the Old Testament is usually measured in groves of olives, vineyards, sheep, goats, and cash, and children. Those of you that are raising kids, just went back to school, you're thinking about how expensive your kids are? Let me tell you something. In the roaring BCs, kids were economic assets. You didn't spend money taking them to buy ice cream every day, buddy. You waited till they could walk and you worked them. You worked them. The whole idea is that God was going to bring forth a chosen race from which salvation would come to the world, but that God was going to bless Abraham in time and in space. When you study the Old Testament, there doesn't seem to be a thing wrong with having financial resources. The problem occurs when wealth is placed into the human heart in the parking spot that should be reserved for God. And that's the parking spot right in the middle of our core. When people love money more than they love God, that's a problem. When people seek money more than they seek God, that's a problem. When people accumulate treasures on earth to the neglect of heaven, that's a problem. Make no mistake, Jesus was concerned about how people handled their resources. In fact, he talked more about money and possessions than heaven and hell combined. For him, what people did with their money gave witness to the contents of their heart. In fact, if you really want to look at what's important to you, get out your banking app and look at where you spend your money. It's a pretty good indicator of what's important to you. Now keep in mind, Jesus' previous section was about offerings, prayer, and fasting. And he described two very different types of bank accounts. The first is earthly, instant, and temporal. The second is heavenly, delayed, and eternal. His consistent point is that all good deeds are rewarded, and we get to choose which of the two accounts we want to deposit in. In our last section, Jesus has sort of just given us the facts about heavenly finances. But today he's going to offer advice. Jesus is going to give practical advice about practical things because Jesus came from practical people. And his ministry was to practical people. Salt of the earth, if you will. Always remember, when God chose earthly parents for his son, he didn't go to the palace. He went to a little village. And he gave a child to a working family. And that's where God chose to have his son raised. When Jesus chooses disciples, he doesn't go to the Harvard Galilee campus. He goes to the fishing docks. He sprinkles a few people in that can write. That's really helpful. Matthew. I mean, it's really helpful. But this whole Christian movement, it's a movement of ordinary people. I love what Abraham Lincoln said God must have a real penchant for ordinary people because he made so many of them. Ordinary people are Jesus' stock. Ordinary people were Jesus' audience. Ordinary people is who Jesus came to minister to heal, to offer hope. It's the extraordinary people that killed him. Verse 19, don't store up treasures here on earth. A primary feature of Jesus' ministry is helping people see the difference between things that matter and things that don't matter, between things that are short-term and things that are long-term, between things that are temporal and things that are eternal. Jesus thought that those who deposited their rewards on earth were foolish. How's that for a strong opinion? He said they were foolish. And those who choose to receive rewards in heaven are wise. We used to call such advice horse sense in southern Illinois. And it just meant you had some sense about you. There was always this grain of doubt that if you left DuCoin and got book learning, you'd lose all your horse sense. Now, emerging from a section about rewards in heaven, Jesus is going to strongly caution us about hoarding treasures on earth. Listen to this parable he told in Luke's gospel. A part of the role of rabbis, like Jesus, was to settle minor civil matters among the Jews. The Romans really appreciated it because A, they didn't understand Jewish law, and B, they didn't care. They just didn't care. Like somebody would walk up to a Roman and they'd say, settle this matter. And the Roman would look at them and say, why would we possibly care? And they'd just walk off, all right? So the Jews handled Jewish small claims, civil type matters. So the fact that this request is made of Jesus seems odd to us, but it wouldn't have been odd to them. This man is looking for a legal interpretation according to the law of Moses. But Jesus doesn't hear his words. He looks into his heart. And inside this man's heart, he does not see a desire for justice. He sees greed. He sees a desire for worldly things. He sees a desire to build up treasures here on earth. Here's the story. Luke 12, 13 through 21. Then someone called from the crowd, teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. That'll let you know court cases haven't shifted a whole lot in their content over 2,000 years. Jesus replied, friend, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as that? I love that. Yeah. And then he said, beware. Guard against every kind of greed, because life is not measured by how much you own. Isn't that interesting? He's saying, whatever you think you're going to get out of this, Captain, you need to rethink it. You think you're going to be happy? Because you get your father's inheritance, that's not going to make you happy. Because life is not measured by how much you own. And then Jesus told them a story. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced fine crops. He said to himself, what should I do? I don't have room for all my crops. Well, here would have been something he could have done. Sold them at a fair market value to poor, hungry people. No, this doesn't cross his mind at all. This doesn't cross his mind at all. He says, I know. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have enough room to store all my wheat and other goods. Why is he storing his wheat? Why is he storing his other goods? He's wanting to drive up prices. He's wanting to drive up prices. You say, that's just good business. Jesus is a terrible businessman. I'm serious. Jesus is a terrible businessman. He's not thinking dollars and cents. He's already established this. Life is not measured by how much you own. And then the man says, I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, I love this. He calls himself his friend. He's his own best friend. My friend, you have stored away enough for years to come. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Are you aware that that saying came from this passage? Eat, drink, and be merry. Most of you thought, well, I thought that was Shakespeare. So here we go. But God said to him, You fool! You fool! You will die this very night. And then who will get everything you worked for? It's a great story, isn't it? You know? You fool! You're going to die tonight. And then who's going to get everything? He concludes, yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God. If you read the Gospel of Luke, is really concerned with what we do with possessions more than any other gospel. And in Luke, sharing and hospitality are a major feature of the Christian life. A major feature. So Luke's beef, and again, remember, Luke is not one of the 12 disciples. Luke is probably Paul's doctor. But again, it's a good thing Jesus had some people around who could write. Because Luke is a Greek, Luke can write. So they're really helpful. But Luke's going to be much later here. But part of Luke's bent is that Christian people should be generous people. Christian people shouldn't be people who hoard treasures on earth, but they should be people who accumulate treasures in heaven. And that runs throughout his gospel. Read Luke sometime. It'll only take you a couple hours to read Luke, and I'm very serious. You know, a lot of you are going to go home tonight, and you're going to watch maybe a movie or something. It's going to take 2 hours. Why don't you read Luke? That'd be a cool thing to do, right? No commercials? Boom! It's awesome! You guys remember when they came out with cable TV? The whole selling point was you won't have commercials. You got to pay for it, but you won't have commercials. Well, now you pay for it, and they have commercials. No commercials in the Bible. Just read it. Read Luke, but read it with the bent of how people use their resources. It's really, really interesting in the Gospel of Luke. But the warning here is really clear. Don't desire what will destroy your soul. Don't desire what will become your God. Don't desire what's going to hurt you. One of the features of ancient Galilee was that it was an historical war zone. In the roaring BCs, Mesopotamian superpowers would clash with Egypt every few centuries for control of what is called the Fertile Crescent. Anybody remember Western Civ? It's the Fertile Crescent. It is the birthplace of civilization. It's where they invented everything from soap to beer to cities. And everything happens in the Fertile Crescent, all right? So controlling the Fertile Crescent is a really, really big thing. The Egyptians are usually pretty salty, but over in the Mesopotamian side, you've got like the Persians and the Assyrians and a whole group of other folks that they'll get strong for a period of time, but you don't get the Fertile Crescent until you deal with Egypt. So it seems like that all these battles between Mesopotamian superpowers and Egypt seem to happen in the Valley of Jezreel, also called Armageddon. This is where the showdowns often occurred. It's also where the final showdown is slated to happen. Now, in part, the scraps occur there because it's the breadbasket of Israel. It's where you grow crops. It is the breadbasket. It is the most lucrative thing in Israel. The Valley of Jezreel and the lake, the Sea of Galilee, are the two most lucrative things in Israel. So you want to control them if you're a superpower. But the second reason is because the Valley of Jezreel is just a really nice flat place for a scrap. And once you get into the Bronze Age and people start coming up with chariots and whatnot, it's not terribly rocky. It has topsoil of all the things. And you can run your chariots on it. It's a pretty good place for what they would have considered modern warfare in the roaring BCs. So a lot of these battles take place here. Now, stay with me. Wealth, historically, is pretty hard to hold on to in a place like Galilee. In fact, the city of Megiddo, which we will visit again, which I actually visit every trip I take to Israel, the city of Megiddo is actually just a tell now, but it has 30 civilizations that have been stacked on top of one another. Why? Because civilizations would get destroyed in these scraps. They would be literally war zones. And they would get completely destroyed. They'd rebuild, and rebuild and rebuild, and over time, you get a mound where the city used to be. But what happened is wealth is historically hard to protect in unstable regions like the Galilee, because things like homes and fields and orchards and vineyards could be lost in a minute. You could think you owned stuff and you could be making a good living, but all it took was some Assyrians or Babylonians or Persians or Egyptians to come down, conquer your city, pillage your countryside, kill your sons, steal your daughters, steal everything you have, and give your land to somebody else. Happens like that. Since armies didn't move lightning fast, people tended to diversify their portfolios. So they included things like sheep and goats. Why? Because you can move them. You get a heads up, you can move them out of harm's way. It's hard to move a vineyard. So people begin to invest in what I would call mobile assets. They also invested in coins. Why would you invest in coins? You can hide them. Hard to hide a house. We're going to tear down this house and we're going to hide it underground. That is not a great idea. So you can hide coins. They also invested in fine garments. We don't think about this. We think of clothing as something that loses 100% of its value the moment you buy it, right? I mean, think about it. You buy a suit, and let's say your suit costs $200 American. The second you put that suit on, it is suddenly worth $6 at Savers, okay? I mean, you talk about depreciation. Boom, it hits really, really hard. Well, back in those days, garments were made of gold thread, silver thread. You may have gold buttons. Garments were expensive, and some of these were a way of investing in wealth. Now, we're three decades into the Common Era. The Romans have neutralized the marauding Mesopotamians, which would be a great name for a high school nickname, the marauding Mesopotamians. I would love that. But the financial habits of the people have been kind of ingrained through the centuries. So when the Romans took Israel in 64 AD, they took Jerusalem in 63 AD. Remember, AD counts down, not up, okay? It counts down towards zero. When they seized the region, took it Syria, which included Israel, they basically took all the private property. They took all of the private property and they gave it to wealthy Romans who were absentee landowners. So the people continued to handle what wealth they had as they had always handled it, because anything you had could be taken, and anything you could hide from the Romans, you didn't have to pay taxes on. So investing in coins that you could bury, we would call that a tax shelter. Investing in sheep you can move, tax shelter. Investing in clothing you can hide, tax shelter. Anything you can hide from the Romans is money still in your pocket. Now, coins and clothing are pretty easy to conceal and move, but they are perishable in their nature. Coins hidden too long in the ground in wet areas rust. Expensive garments can be destroyed by moths. How many of you are old enough to remember when moths used to destroy clothes? That's before the Lord invented polyester, right? And both could be stolen. Both could be stolen. Sheep, goats can be stolen. Regardless, in the absence of secure banks and the FDIC, there was really not such a thing as a safe investment in ancient Israel. Now, let's get to our text, 21 and 20. Store your treasures in heaven, for where your treasure is, there your heart and thoughts will also be. In Jewish thought, the heart was considered the essence of the person. In some African cultures, it's the throat. In some cultures, it's the liver. But in Jewish thought, the heart is the essence of the person. It's pretty easy for us because it still is here in America. The heart is the soul, the source, or the core, if you will. Jesus is reminding us that whatever occupies our core reveals the contents of what we value most, or let me push it a little further, reveals what we truly worship. The Greek word for worship is an interesting study. It's a compound word called proskuneo. Pros means to turn toward. Skuneo means to give someone a kiss. Not in a romantic sense necessarily, but it means to turn toward someone for the purpose of giving them either a greeting or a romantic kiss. Turn toward for the purpose of a kiss. In a sense, what we turn toward is what we worship. And once again, Jesus challenges us to turn toward heavenly treasure. And when you turn toward something, you're by definition turning away from something else. He says, turn away from earthly treasure, turn toward heavenly treasure. Why? Because you can't face two directions at once. The next couple of verses are difficult because the concept has changed. But the big idea is they thought, okay, the big idea is that light and darkness are contrasted and they both compete for our affections. But let's look at verse 22. It says, your eye allows your inward light to shine. The metaphor here is really alien to us, but what he really says in the Greek is your pure eye allows light to shine. It's interesting, but regular people in Jesus' time didn't exactly understand how the body worked because it was kind of considered bad form to cut people open and study them. Okay? I mean, it was just considered bad form. Read about the Europeans early who started cutting people open and studying them. They are kind of some of the founders of modern medicine, but people thought they were super freaky weirdos, okay? I mean, you know, what's your Uncle Bob doing? He's just out there with a cadaver and a knife. I mean, it's all bad. So they didn't really understand how the body works in the same way we do. So many people back then incorrectly thought the human eye emitted the light by which it sees. They thought the human eye emitted the light by which it sees rather than responds to what light there is to work with. So in a sense, the eye was sort of like a flashlight. Light was formed inwardly and projected forward. Eyes were dimmed at night, so night's bad. Eyes are brightened during the day. Day's good. A bright heart shone through bright eyes. What Jesus is really saying here using their own description is that he's saying that whatever our inner core values are determines our worldview. How we see the world determines by how we think, what shapes us, what forms our heart. And then he says in verse 23, and an evil eye, don't you love that? An evil eye. An evil eye plunges you into darkness. Give someone the evil eye, right? Well, do you guys have any teachers in school that used to give you the evil eye? Do you have a mother who used to give you the evil eye? Don't point. Okay. An evil eye projected the contents of a dim heart or an evil heart. The Bible's pretty consistent in its metaphors that light is good, darkness is bad. Good things happen in the light, bad things happen in the dark. What's done in the dark will be brought to light. That's always good. Spiritual darkness occurs when we don't have enough light in us to see. So we stumble at best, we become lost at worst. People who love the dark spend their resources on pleasures and things done in the dark. When I was in high school, I had a friend named Leland Doubts. His father's name was Apple. I have no idea what his real name was, but he was called Apple Doubts. And Apple had this incredible theory that really didn't work well for Leland as a high school student. He believed that nothing good happened after 9 o'clock at night. He was, of course, correct when we were in high school, but it didn't work out great for Leland. So every time, Leland had to be home at 9 o'clock. Wouldn't you like to be 18 years old and have to be home at 9 o'clock? This is incredible. Oh, at our age, we're thrilled to be home at 9 o'clock. I go to bed now the same time I used to leave home on weekends. So the whole idea was that nothing good happens when? Where? In the darkness. Bad things happen in the darkness. Now Jesus is going to drive this all home. Last scripture. This is where it all going to kind of come together. No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and money. Money is a neutral concept in the Bible that leans a little positive in the Old Testament. But the money word used here is not Greek, it's Aramaic. It's really interesting. The word for money, mammon, is not Greek. It's Aramaic. You got to remember, Jesus would have spoken in Aramaic, and they would have written in Greek. Why didn't they write in Hebrew and speak in Hebrew like they did in the Old Testament? Two answers. The Romans. The Romans changed everything. They changed the world. You're going to be in the Roman Empire, you're going to write in Greek. There's a 400-year span between the Old and New Testaments. And during that time, Hebrew is functionally a lost language that truly isn't going to be revived until the formation of Israel in 1948. Other than Bible scholars and a handful of really, really etymological nerds, Hebrew doesn't really get formed again until Israel becomes a nation in 1948. 9 million people in the world speak Hebrew today. 9 million people in the world. In 1920, you might have had 20. Or 1920. But there weren't many. Matthew does something really cool in this verse. He includes a unique concept from the common spoken language into the commonly written language. It would be sort of us, because now we... Have you noticed Americans kind of have a little bit of Spanglish going? There are a lot of Spanish words that I use in my everyday word. I tend to say mañana instead of tomorrow. I've got some Spanish things that are in my normal dictionary now. They're in my lexicon when I talk. So at times I will throw a Spanish word into an American sentence or an English sentence, which is an American sentence would just be a corrupted English sentence. So I'll toss it in there. Well, what he's done here is he's tossed an Aramaic word into a Greek sentence. But we can define mammon as a word that didn't have a good Greek definition, so that's why he has to use it. Mammon simply is money gone wrong. Money defiled. Money perverted. It's bad money. Blood money. And in mammon, money shifts from a neutral thing in Greek to a negative thing in Aramaic. Mammon is what competes directly with God for worship in the hearts of humanity. As Jesus begins this section, once again, his listeners are forced to make a choice. Before, they could either deposit their rewards on earth or in heaven, but now Jesus says, you're going to either serve God or you're going to serve money. Mammon is what pleasure can buy. And money is what buys pleasure. And Jesus says, you can either serve God or you can serve money. But you can't do both. You can love God or you can love the things of this world. But you can't do both. And what reveals most definitively what we love? How we spend our money. How we spend our money. One of the great things about the Christian act of tithing, which comes off of the offerings before, is that it shatters the illusion we can safely sit on the fence separating God and mammon. It's a wishbone that doesn't break in the middle. Clearly, there's a debate, even today in church circles, about what constitutes the proper use of money in the life of a Christian. But when I talk with Christian people about money, there are about three prevailing attitudes. Number one, some people see all they have is God's. And so for them, the only decision is what of God's resources should they keep. The other is that they believe that what they've been given is a blessing as long as they give God God's portion. And the other one is that God shouldn't really be concerned about money because I'm not going to give him any. Those are kind of the three schools. And actually, they run pretty evenly within the church. Did you know about 40% of the people who attend a church will never give one dime? So they run reasonably evenly. What I really like about this teaching is I love the fact Jesus isn't afraid to get in your grill. So one of the things I thought as I was concluding this tonight, I thought, how can I help Christian people like you who love Jesus enough to show up on a Wednesday night? I mean, that ought to be at least a three-pointer, right? How can I help Christians like you think through what the proper use of money is? I was acculturated very, very young into what I would call a tithing life. When I was a kid, I got $1 a week, provided I did my chores and kept most of my opinions to myself. I still do my chores and keep most of my opinions to myself. Wait till I retire. Boy, will I have fun. But I was given $1 a week, but it was given to me and changed. Does anybody want to guess why? Because a tenth of that went to the Lord. The first dime of that was God's. And I remember being a kid, putting that dime in the offering plate. What's really cool was the rest kind of seemed to be mine. And that was great because Dad would take us to town. It was kind of like when the Darlings went to town on the Andy Griffith Show. He would take us into Pinckneyville, which was, of course, a big city back then. But I was smaller. And so he would take us, and I like had 90 cents to spend. And, buddy, I hit the town hard. I hit the town hard. Stotler Drugs sold strawberry soda for 15 cents, and they sold Snickers for a dime. 25 cents got you a strawberry soda and a Snicker bar. Win. Win. Then I went and bought as many packs of baseball cards as I could. Another win. And then I usually had a few cents left over, and you could buy candy with pennies that was actually decent. What you put a quarter in a machine to get now used to cost a penny. And you could get some good stuff for a penny, at least enough to rot through your teeth out. So this is kind of how you did it. But from the very time I was a boy, I was just taught to tithe. I never knew a way of thinking about money where I didn't tithe. I just didn't know a way of thinking about it. So a lot of people who are in church and want to be serious disciples of Jesus weren't raised like that. And so let me just offer you seven things as I close about the whole money thing. And let me just share with you from my heart what I believe to be true. And you may disagree with it, and that's fine. Just let me know how it all works for you. So here we go. Number one, the Old Testament teaches that we give God 10% of our income. You say, well, Pastor, where do you get that? Well, it's actually the word tithe. The tithe means 10%. So that's not a rocket science piece there. So the Old Testament says that we give God 10% of our increase. Again, they're going to deal in a barter society. So you're going to have grain and a lot of those kind of things. You know, if you got 10 goats, God gets one. That's the idea. Number two, the New Testament does not so much reiterate that, but it simply adds that we tithe cheerfully, and it warns us not to let the tithe replace compassion and justice. So just because you tithe doesn't mean you get to be a jerk. But Jesus at no point said we're supposed to stop tithing. In fact, he said, when you tithe, just make sure that you do it with a cheerful heart and make sure you don't let it replace compassion and justice. Just because you put your dime in from your allowance, if you've got a kid that can't afford milk at school, you need to be willing to flip them a nickel. If you need to do it, don't let it replace compassion and justice. Number three, the Bible does not offer specific detail about how to tithe, nor does it offer specific detail about how to fast, or other than the Lord's Prayer, there's not just a whole lot on how to pray. So the Bible doesn't really say this is exactly how you tithe. Number four, I give my tithes to the church. Do you have to give your tithes to the church? You don't have to give tithes at all. But I give my tithes to the church. I do it for a few reasons. One is I know where the money goes. Two, I see people coming to Jesus on a regular basis here. You realize we had four baptisms at our Millstadt campus last Sunday. Those are the kind of things for me You know, people have all kinds of ideas about what a church ought to be doing. Let me tell you what I think a church ought to be doing. We ought to be making new Christians. We ought to be baptizing them. We ought to be making disciples, and we ought to be sending people out to make new Christians. That's what I think the church ought to be doing. And so when that stuff happens, I'm starting to get pretty excited about it. So I tie it to the church. I tie it to the local church. Number five, I give offerings on top of a tithe when I'm pinged. When God just kind of pings me in some way. Did you know it's impossible to give an offering if you haven't tithed biblically? Offerings always come on top of tithes. Until you give 10%, you can't mathematically give an offering until you've tithed. So I give a tithe, and then I give offerings as God puts it on my heart. Let me tell you a couple things I like to do. Melissa and I support 6 kids in the Philippines. We support their education. They're Christ Church scholars. That's all coming up in about 3 weeks here at Christ Church. We'll be renewing those. But we got 6 kids who are in school instead of living their lives knee-deep in water in a rice field because Melissa and I support them. That's something I do with my offerings, okay? So what I do with my offerings, I give my tithes to church. I give my offerings where I feel pinged. If somebody is in need, I know about it, I feel pinged to help them, boom, I can give an offering there. I don't take that out of what I give the church. It's in addition to. Number five, number six, we must be willing to give everything if God would ask. We need to be willing to give everything. Should God ask? And I don't want to say that flippantly, but I do want to say it sincerely. If God should ask you for everything, the proper response is yes. Yes. We have to be willing to give all should God ask. Every day I wake up and I am grateful that I am the pastor of this incredible church. I mean, I am. I am grateful. But I got to tell you, if God called me to be a missionary and go live in a hut, I need to be willing to go live in a hut. I need to just do what God asked me to do. And I need to be willing to give everything if God should ask. And we all need to be willing to give everything if God should ask. And then I got the great part for you. Number seven, if you've done all these other things, I think whatever remains is just a blessing. I don't think you got to sit around feeling guilty all day about everything. Do you know, I have people ask me for money all the time. You know, I'll go somewhere. Would you like to give this? Would you like to do that? Would you like to do that? You know what I always tell them? No, thank you. I give at my church. And I just smile at them. I don't feel guilty about that at all. Why? Because I'm giving my tithes. Obviously, I didn't feel a ping because I slipped it right back at them, right? I didn't feel a ping. So I just give my tithes to church. I give my offerings, but I don't have to feel guilty that I can't do everything or give to every single thing. I don't have to live in guilt. I don't have to live in condemnation if I know that I have tithed, I've given offerings as God has laid it on my heart. I'm willing to give everything if God should ask, and what remains is a blessing. I think one of the great things about the Sermon on the Mount is its utter practicality. I'm going to ask you to pray about what's been shared. Take a look in Scripture, see where it's all at. Had somebody walk up to me a couple years ago after church. They said, "What you said today made me so mad, I spent the whole day in the Bible." I said, "Then I have done a terrific job."